And Radio Derby's on the air, continuing our new style of presenting interesting or unusual versions of Haydn's Derbyshire Marches, at least until the nation screams for us to stop. That was one of the marches played on the piano, simultaneously with Old Hundredth on the organ. Eccentric, I know. It actually reminded me of that comedy quiz show that used to run on the radio over in England, called I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. The point of the show was to get the panel of comedians to do silly things. One thing they frequently had to do was sing the words of one song to the tune of another. For example, the words of Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious to the tune of Deutschland über alles. Supercalifragilistic. See, it's harder than you'd think. Okay, we're still looking for someone who can give us a good rendering of Haydn on the spoons. Meanwhile, this is your eclectically genial host, John Derbyshire, with a roundup of news and opinions on this Thanksgiving week and week three of the Trumpening. Greetings to all, and I hope your Thanksgiving dinner was not the scene of too much political rancour. In the event that it was, I am told that gravy and stuffing stains on wallpaper can be removed with an application of dilute Clorox bleach. In the event it really was, bloodstains are best tackled with cold water while still fresh. It is a joyous Thanksgiving for us immigration patriots as our man continues interviewing for his executive team, while the nation echoes to the festive sound of liberals' heads exploding. Oh, there goes another one. Happy, happy days. As Radio Derb goes to tape here, the Donald is taking a Thanksgiving break with the family down at his spread in Palm Beach, Florida. Sincere wishes from us here to them there for a cheerful and relaxing long weekend. This follows a week of firming up some lower-level picks for the Trump cabinet. We got Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo as nominee for CIA director, a post which needs Senate confirmation. And we got General Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor, which doesn't. I can't claim to know much about either person, but they are hated by all the right people, so that's good. In the case of National Security Advisor, it's also hopeful to look at who General Flynn is replacing. Mulatto mafia diversocrat Susan Rice, eager camp follower of Mrs. Clinton and one of Radio Derb's designated three horse girls of the Libyan apocalypse, the other two being Samantha Power and the Hilda Beast itself. General Flynn can only be an improvement. Later in the week, we got some more minor picks. Nikki Haley, Governor of South Carolina, is to be our ambassador to the United Nations. I can't say I'm a fan of Governor Haley. After a lunatic with a Confederate battle flag in his attic murdered 9 people in Charleston last year, Governor Haley led the charge to eliminate the flag from public display, thereby ceding public policy to the whims of lunatics. Ambassador to the UN is, however, such a joke of a posting that I can't work up any feelings about the appointment. The UN is a waste of good New York real estate, as I hope President Trump will come to realise. My personal pick for this job, would have been Pee-wee Herman. Another diversity pick seems to be Ben Carson for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. I say seems to be because Dr. Carson is playing the shy bride, declining to say whether he'll take the job or not. Apparently he wants to be courted. This confirms the dark suspicions about Dr. Carson that you hear in some quarters. But again, this is not a very consequential post, so nothing to get worked up about one way or the other. I don't even understand why the Republic needs a Department of Housing and Urban Development. Isn't this just a legacy of the mid-20th century planning craze? The philosophy that gave us Brasilia, Cabrini Green, and the chancrous housing projects of Liverpool, where I worked for 2 years? Again, though, Dr. Carson is at least an American of some professional accomplishment. He'd make a refreshing contrast with the current HUD secretary, affirmative action mediocrity Julian Castro. My dismissive feelings about the posts of UN ambassador and HUD secretary can be squared and cubed for the post of education secretary. I wrote in We Are Doomed that, quote, the whole culture of professional educators is addled with chicanery, corruption, rent-seeking, time-serving, and lies. Reading through the literature of present-day EdBiz, every time you think you've found an argument, assertion, or proposal than which nothing could possibly be dumber, something dumber soon shows up. End quote. I have since become much more negative. I have in fact progressed from being an education minimalist to an education nihilist. It's all just a stupendous waste to no purpose. I'll qualify my nihilism slightly. I'll allow that up to about fourth or fifth grade, kids need to be sat at desks in rows under firm discipline and have the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic hammered into their silly heads. Everything after that, though, is just childminding. Whether this has always been the case, I couldn't swear. 19th century Britain, which built a vast and remarkably efficient world empire staffed by men whose education consisted entirely of memorising Latin texts, suggests that it has been. Regardless, in this age of cell phones and iPads, there is surely no doubt that any inquisitive child can learn anything he wants to learn without adult supervision. A great many kids, of course, don't want to learn anything. And they won't, under any system. They don't learn anything now, as we see every time some TV show sends a reporter into the streets to ask passers-by the name of the vice president, or to say which century the Civil War was fought in. My own two kids, both bright and witty, and raised in a house full of books, did 4 years of school Spanish each. Neither of them can utter a complete sentence in Spanish. Education is a crock. Federal supervision of education is just another layer of make-work bureaucracy, a fifth or sixth layer of crock management. I suspect and hope Donald Trump knows this. Whether he does or not, the president has no power to disband the Department of Education, which would be the most beneficial thing for the country. He has therefore nominated some fellow billionaire's wife for the post of Education Secretary. I'm sure she'll do fine. For those of us convinced that continuing mass third world immigration is the major threat to our republic, with the malicious stoking of anti-white resentment as a runner-up in the threat league, President Trump's cabinet is, anyway, a tadpole, a huge and very important head attached to a not very consequential tail. That head is comprised of the two posts that oversee most of our population policy, Attorney General and Secretary of Homeland Security. Those two posts don't encompass all of our population policy. The State Department has significant input to our refugee resettlement programs, a vast and corrupt money racket. State Department employees in our embassies and consulates abroad also issue visas. Far too many, with far too little scrutiny. I'd dearly like to see an immigration patriot at state, but it doesn't look as though I'm going to. Attorney General and DHS Secretary are the big ones, though, the head of the tadpole. The news that Senator Jeff Sessions is under serious consideration for AG, and that Chris Kobach is under similar consideration for the DHS, is simply wonderful. These are two men who want the people's laws on entry and immigration firmly enforced. And in the many areas where the laws work against the interests of US citizens, they want the laws changed. With Senator Jeff as AG, there will also be a righteous cleaning out of the stables at the Justice Department. The Civil Rights Division of that department has degenerated into an ATM for anti-white activist groups, sluicing public money to them through grants and lawsuits. With Sessions in charge, the race hustlers will have to find real jobs in the actual economy, if they can. Immigration issues aside, that will be something wonderful to see. We don't have either man in office yet, though. The cheap labour lobbies and the anti-white activists will fight tooth and nail to prevent congressional confirmation of these patriots. They might succeed. The Senate has to confirm both nominations. In the 115th Congress, which takes its seats on January 3rd, the Senate will likely have 52 Republicans, 46 Democrats, and 2 independents. Independent is a fancy way of saying left liberal. Indeed, one of the two independents is Bernie Sanders. The other is Angus King of Maine, graded F- on immigration by Numbers USA. That's worse than Bernie, who's a C-. So, it's 52-48 in the Senate. The 48 are, of course, all going to vote both Sessions and Kobach down. If the Third World immigration spigot is shut off, the Democratic Party has no future. The 52 are problematic, though. Some high proportion of the GOP senators are bought and paid for shills for the cheap labour lobbies, what we at VDare.com sometimes call the slave power. The mentality of Jeb Bush, who ran for the GOP nomination on a platform of preferring Mexicans to Americans, is widespread among Republicans. This is going to be the fight of the century. We can win it, though. We have killed 2 attempts to force immigration amnesty through Congress. We can kill the efforts to block Sessions and Kobach using the same methods. Call, email, and write your senators. Don't let up on them. They respond to this kind of pressure. It's worked before. It'll work again. The tadpole without a head is a sorry sight. This Broadway musical, Hamilton, is telling us something interesting about our culture, although I can't quite figure out what. In case you've just emerged after a year and a half in a sensory deprivation tank, Hamilton is a musical about Alexander Hamilton and the American Revolution, with an almost entirely non-white cast, and the music all in Negro modes, rhythm and blues and hip-hop. I don't personally mind any of that. Artists must experiment, or we never find new ways of amusing ourselves. We do, unfortunately, seem to be living in an era of history where the experiments rarely deliver anything lasting. Gerald Friedman staged a production of Titus Andronicus set on the surface of the moon. Jonathan Miller produced a Rigoletto with the Duke and his men as mafiosi in New York's Little Italy. Okay, keep trying, guys. As you can tell, I'm not myself a keen consumer of this sort of thing, but I don't see any principled objection to people trying it. I haven't seen Hamilton, and I don't plan to. I've read two reviews, Rick Brookhiser's favourable one and Gregory Hood's scathing one. I've watched clips from some of the song and dance numbers on YouTube. I still have no urge to buy a ticket for the thing, certainly not at the absurdly inflated prices I see quoted, not while Mozart, Verdi, Wagner and, be still my heart, Bellini, are on offer at the Met for half those prices. That, however, is just the voice of a geezer who hasn't taken much interest in pop music since the Nixon administration. So don't take me as your entertainment guide. The real interest of Hamilton for me is sociological. Having attended this show is a status marker for good white gentry liberals. A ticket stub from Hamilton isn't just a showbiz souvenir, it's a virtue signal. Gregory Hood tells us that the audience is, quote, overwhelmingly white. This raises all sorts of awkward questions that good whites seem not capable of asking. For example, isn't Hamilton just a minstrel show? Doesn't the phrase cultural appropriation apply? Would a show about the civil rights movement with an all-white cast, Johnny Depp playing Martin Luther King perhaps, would that be acceptable? And so on. Well, I'll leave you to ponder these deep issues among yourselves. Hamilton was in the news this week because Vice President-elect Mike Pence attended a performance last Friday, November 18th, and was booed by the audience. Then, after the curtain calls at the end of the performance, the black actor who plays Aaron Burr came up to stage front and read Pence a whiny little lecture about how, quote, alarmed and anxious, end quote, non-white Americans are over Donald Trump's election. I thought he was going to beg the new administration to set aside some safe spaces, but he stopped short of that. Mike Pence, who is the very soul of Midwestern nice, took it all in good part. I'm not sure that's the right approach. To be lectured by a bunch of bubblehead actors is neither here nor there. They're actors. Who cares what they think? The behaviour of the audience was disgraceful, though, and I don't think niceness is the correct response. As George Orwell observed, quote, "If someone drops a bomb on your mother, go and drop two bombs on his mother." End quote. That's more the New York spirit. I hope it's the Trump spirit. Good whites pose as our moral superiors. So tolerant, open-minded, progressive, humane. They are, in fact, though, nasty pieces of work. Vindictive, self-righteous, cruel, contemptuous of their fellow citizens. The correct response to all that is not niceness. It's a good hard kick in the crotch. Mike Pence's niceness seems in fact to be in danger of making him a standard target for good white contempt. An emblem for them of the flyover rubes whose bad white stupidity brought us President-elect Trump. If you want to plumb the depths of that contempt, the sneering, seething disdain and loathing that good white elites feel for their fellow citizens, if you want to plumb that, and if you have a strong stomach, I recommend to your attention the October 10th issue of New Yorker magazine, page 47, title, "The Pences Visit Manhattan." Note the date. This is from before the election. It's a spoof piece mocking the naivety, religious faith, and provincial values of Mr. and Mrs. Pence. The opening two sentences give you the basic idea. Quote, "Governor Mike Pence was having a romantic dinner with the love of his life, Mrs. Mike Pence, at the Red Lobster in Times Square. The governor knew that as vice president he would have to attend foreign banquets, so he and Mrs. Pence were trying to broaden their palates." End quote. It's downhill from there. Read the whole thing if your stomach will take it. And if you can do so without running out into the street and smacking the first good white liberal you meet on his designer stubbled jaw. These are not nice people. Let's return to them the same contempt and loathing they feel for us. Midwestern nice? Pah! Give me New York nasty every time. Hey, jackass! Richard Spencer, a white separatist who is a prominent figure on the alt-right, wound up the conference of his National Policy Institute last Saturday with the following call.
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
Richard then raised high his glass, which he was holding in his right hand, in what looked to me like a toast to those sentiments. That got the audience to their feet, cheering and clapping. Some of them gave a Nazi salute, raising their own right arms up straight, palms out. How many of them? 5 seems to be the consensus number, out of around 200 in the room. That will be less than 3%, which I think is the definition of a lunatic fringe. Because Richard did much to popularise the term alt-right, and because Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's strategy advisor, has said friendly things about the alt-right, this incident, of course, spawned headlines about triumphant Nazis supporting Trump. A 3-minute video clip of snippets from Richard's speech had over 2 million views on YouTube when I looked just now. There is much to be said about this. Roger Dewey said a lot of it in a VDare.com post this Thursday. Here's my 10 cents worth. Although rehearsing it in my mind beforehand it came out as more like 20 cents. So I'll spread my remarks out over two or three segments. My first thought about this fuss was precisely the same as Peter Brimelow's, as also recorded here on VDare.com, November 23rd. Like Peter, I was annoyed with Richard for giving the media this kind of material to feast on, just when all our efforts for patriotic immigration reform might at last be about to get a receptive ear in the White House. It's feeding the beast when we should be gearing up to starve the beast. It also, as Peter wrote, it also threw into the shade a lot of good, sensible things that were said by other speakers at the conference, including Peter himself. Then came my second thought, reacting against my first thought. Second thought in a nutshell. No enemies to the right. I've known Richard for some years. I call him a friend, and I don't trash my friends. I've already ticked off some subset of the Radio Derb listenership just by saying that. I know it. I've had emails and one actual phone call urging me to denounce Richard. Denounce, they urge. Denounce, denounce. If I don't denounce, these people tell me, I will be yoked with Richard in the public mind, and I'll get vilified along with him. I'm sorry to disappoint, but denunciation really isn't my thing. To my ears, it has a whiff of Stalinism about it, the more so since I've been denounced myself. So, sorry, but I just don't do Stalinism. I leave it to Stalinists and to those who are too cowardly to take a stand against them. As for getting vilified as an accomplice of Richard's, if I told you I am quaking in my boots about this, I would be telling you an untruth. I'm 71 years old and I've had cancer. On my personal list of anxieties, being vilified by a shrieking posse of cult Marx bedwetters, or by anyone at all, in fact, is way down low on the list, along with hangnails, a military coup in Malawi, and the heat death of the universe. The pertinent issue here is, of course, not whether I do Stalinism or not, it's whether Richard Spencer and or his followers do Nazism. Let's take a look at that. To the best of my understanding, Richard himself does not do Nazism. His philosophy is an extreme form of ethnocentrism, with a dash of Nietzschean worship of the will. Richard doesn't want to massacre anyone, or enslave anyone, or oppress anyone, or invade anyone. That's Nazism. That's not Richard. He's a separatist. He thinks that peoples, i.e. groups with some clearly identifiable common ethnicity, should have homelands. Hungarians should have Hungary. Japanese should have Japan. Irish should have Ireland. And the white Europeans, who by the mid-20th century had merged into white Americans, should have a homeland of their own. A white America. Somewhere in the Northern Rockies, I think, is this idea. Although I'm not too clear about this geographical aspect. Regarding the Jews, he thinks that Jews share a common ethnicity among themselves and that they are ethnocentric, as, according to Richard, a people should be. He thinks that Jews would be an irritant in his imagined white homeland, promoting their own group even when that went against the common interest. You can hear Kevin MacDonald moving around behind the scenery there. Professor MacDonald was in fact a speaker at this NPI conference. I assume, although again I'm not totally clear about this, I assume that Richard is glad for the Jews to have Israel as their homeland. For someone of Richard's views, supposing I have described them correctly, Zionism is something of an inspiration. What the Zionists did is what Richard dreams of doing, carving out a homeland for his people. In his speech at the conference, he actually quoted Theodor Herzl, who was the George Washington of modern Zionism, to the bafflement of the New York Times. He did so cheekily, but that's Richard's style, cheeky. I'll say more about that in a moment. And on the subject of anti-Semitism, I'll note in passing that in the year 2016, anti-Semitism is today much more characteristic of the political left than of the right. Britain's Labour Party is now quite openly anti-Semitic. Black Muslim Congressman Keith Ellison, being spoken of this week as the new head of the Democratic National Committee, has a long paper trail of hostility to Israel. He was formerly an associate of Louis Farrakhan. You can, of course, dig out an anti-Semite or two from any point of the political spectrum. But if it's the mother lode you're seeking, the political left is the place to look nowadays. For further insights into Richard's point of view, I recommend the half-hour interview that he gave to Red Ice TV on November 22nd. You can easily find it for yourself by putting Red Ice TV Spencer into the Google search box. If you don't have half an hour to spend on that, here are some main points that Richard makes in the Red Ice interview, with my responses to them. New segment. Okay, here are some of Richard's main points in response to the fuss, with my comments on his responses. Point one, the Roman salute. Richard denies that those five audience members were giving a Nazi salute. He calls it a Roman salute. I'm sorry, but that strikes me as a bit disingenuous. It's true that the Romans used to salute like that. And it's also true that the success and power of the Roman Empire is a minor theme in Richard's presentations, as a glowing example of what white Europeans can do when they will it. Red Ice says that the Roman Empire was mentioned in the conference somewhere in that context, although I haven't watched all 12 hours of the conference video, so I can't confirm that. It wasn't only Romans, in fact. Americans used to do the straight arm salute too. It was called the Bellamy salute, or the flag salute. You can look it up. It has a Wikipedia page. You did the Bellamy salute as you recited the Pledge of Allegiance. Quote from the Wikipedia page. It was officially replaced by the hand-over-heart salute when Congress amended the Flag Code on December 22, 1942. End quote. Okay. But the Nazis poisoned that well for good, along with many others. I have a side interest in linguistics. I can tell you that the huge family to which most languages of Europe, West Asia, and North India belong is called Indo-European. It used to be called Aryan, which is a perfectly good descriptor with an impeccable etymology. So, why do we now use six clumsy syllables to name this language family, where formerly we used two crisp ones? You know why. Poisoned wells, poisoned by the damn Nazis. It's futile to try unpoisoning them unless you're seriously bereft of any better way to spend your time. You just have to go along with this stuff. So, sorry, Richard, that salute is a Nazi salute. To deny that is just cranky and eye-roll-inducing, like calling our language family Aryan would be. Our grandfathers said Aryan with no ill intent. Our grandfathers gave the Bellamy salute likewise. That was then. This is now. Point two. There is no such thing as bad publicity. Everybody's now talking about the alt-right. Richard's ideas have a public audience now, which formerly they didn't. Some portion of that audience will respond positively to them. That's his argument. My response: okay, but the alt-right is a big tent. Nazi salutes are going to turn off people who might be receptive to non-Spencerian alt-right ideas. Ideas like my less rigid ethnocentrism. The beliefs that, yes, to be stable and harmonious, I agree, that a nation needs to maintain a supermajority of one race. 90% is about right. While practicing tolerance and legal equality for racial minorities. But while also practicing honest realism about race differences. I'd like people to take up those ideals of mine. If they have Nazi salutes on their mind, many won't who otherwise might. Point three, owning the insult. The cult Marx crowd call us Nazis anyway, says Richard correctly. They call you a Nazi if you oppose affirmative action or Black Lives Matter, or if you just speak openly about black misbehaviour. They call you a Nazi if you favour tax reduction, or charter schools, or immigration law enforcement. Screw 'em! Throw it right back at 'em. Nazi, you say? How'd you like this then, suckers? I'm not unsympathetic to that approach. I'm even a little envious. Why envious? Well, let me relabel that as point 3A. It goes with a different point, point 3B. Here's point 3B. Point 3B, ironic exuberance. The crowd at the NPI conference was a young crowd. A friend who was there estimates the median age at around 30. Richard himself is 38. If you're in your 30s like that, you grew up under strict ideological conformity. Your teachers and your college instructors were solidly cult Marx. The movies and TV programs you watched were all impregnated with the cult Marx ether. Anti-American, anti-white, anti-male, anti-heterosexual. Your boomer parents were likely cult Marx, from dad's ponytail to mom's Birkenstocks. Young people of spirit are naturally going to kick back against that. 3 years ago at Tacky Mag, I posted a column titled, "Why Isn't Racism Cool?" If you're a spunky young person, I wrote, one of life's sweetest pleasures is vexing your elders. There's hardly any fun in being young. if you're not ticking off your parents. Given that the parents of an educated 30-something are likely to be left liberal boomers, what's going to tick them off more than racism? There's a lot of that among the younger alt-right crowd. There's also a lot of irony. They've grown up in an age of irony. To Americans my age, who didn't, it's noticeable how young people so often speak ironically, sounding like they mean something that they don't really mean. Put those two things together, the desire to vex the stuffy old farts who run the world, and a style of diction and gesture soaked in irony, put them together and you arrive at Richard's claim in the Red Ice interview that what happened, happened, quote, in a spirit of ironic exuberance. Ironic exuberance, yes. With all that in mind, I wasn't very surprised to learn that one of the people photographed giving the ironic Nazi Roman Bellamy salute identifies himself as half Jewish, and another one identifies herself as full Vietnamese. These are high-spirited young people kicking over the traces, sticking it to the old farts by throwing the old farts' most potent insults right back in their faces. Hence my envy. I'm not young. There is, in fact, quite a gulf between geezers like myself, who are more or less sympathetic to the alt-right, and the young fire-eaters who are driving it. This, if you'll excuse me, is worth one more segment by itself. It's common wisdom among military folk that a man is no use in combat after about the age of 35. Age brings caution, reflection, wisdom. If you want a soldier who will run whooping and hollering towards enemy machine gun fire, a 20-year-old is your best bet. Older people think too much. Of course, both the impulsive exuberance of youth and the calm wisdom of age have important social roles to play. If Alexander the Great had had the mentality of a 60-year-old, we'd never have heard of him. If the mature George Washington had been less mature, we'd never have heard of him. Everything in its place. Still, the young fools don't know much, and the geezers can't do much. And this could develop into a real schism among the alt-right. Richard Spencer marching off like the Pied Piper with all the fizzed-up young alt-right spirits. And geezers like me and Peter and Jared Taylor left to drone on to roomfuls of other geezers. That, I think, would be a shame. I think, in fact, it would destroy the whole enterprise. One sign that such a schism had developed would be if alt-right greybeards, like Peter and me and Jared Taylor, refused to have anything to do with Richard Spencer and his organisation. This might actually be happening if some rumours I'm hearing are true. Again, I think it would be a shame. So, Derb, would you yourself speak at one of Richard's functions, given what happened at last week's conference? Yes, I would. But only after I'd seen Richard impose some discipline on his ranks, expel a few nutcases, and give clear assurances that there'd be no Nazi salutes. Or Roman salutes, whatever he wants to call them. To run hollering at an enemy machine gun emplacement is a fine and noble thing for a soldier to do. Good soldiering needs discipline, though, and guidance from greybeards on the general staff working the strategy. In summary, then, Were the antics on display at the end of the NPI conference annoying to those of us anxious to get some practical political work on the national question moved forward without distractions that feed opposition hysteria? Yes, they were. Were those antics not also disrespectful, however accidentally, to the memories of those persons, including some of my close relatives, who fought and suffered to defeat Nazism? Not to mention those who died, either fighting under arms or hustled defenceless into cattle wagons to be murdered after having their property, liberty and dignity stripped from them? Yes, they were. And were those antics also exactly what you would expect to see from young people of intelligence and spirit, reacting spontaneously to having been raised in an atmosphere of stifling ideological conformity, in a political culture vigilantly patrolled by hysterical old maids of both sexes? Yes, they were. And does the media cover-up of the Antifa attacks on conference attendees reveal yet again, as if it needed revealing yet again, that our good white elites are perfectly okay with crude Nazi-style political violence, so long as it's directed against bad whites peacefully assembled? Yes, it does. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis, you can add a new entry to the list of lifestyle, I think more accurately I should say life condition, the list of life condition acronyms. We had yuppies, that was young urban professionals, and their relations, the buppies, black urban professionals. Then we had dinkies. Dinkies, double income, no kids. I'm sure there have been some others I've forgotten. Now, from across the pond, we're hearing about jammies. That's J-A-M for just about managing. November 23rd, the British Chancellor, that's equivalent to Treasury Secretary, the Chancellor gave his autumn statement to Parliament. In a follow-up statement, one of his department spokesflunkies said the following thing, quote, "The government has also taken actions to support people that are just about managing throughout the UK," end quote. Jams turn out to be people who are above the bottom 10% of the income distribution, but who work for low wages and receive few welfare benefits. They have little or nothing saved, and they are vulnerable to inflation, job losses, and life emergencies. They're just about managing. It would be neat if some skilled social analyst... You there, Steve? It would be neat if someone would break out the jams in our US population and then tell us how many of them voted for Trump. My guess, 80%. Item. I use the word anti-white a lot. Possibly some listeners think too much. Well, I don't think so. Hatred of white people is a real force in American life. Sometimes a lethal one. To illustrate that, here are three random headlines from 1 4-day period in one American city. First, from CBS New York, November 20th, headline, "Muggers struck man with skateboard, hurled anti-white slurs, couple claims." Second, New York Daily News, November 23rd, headline, "Queens man cuffed for trying to push strap hanger onto Harlem subway tracks, yelled, "I hate white people." Third, New York Post, November 23rd, headline, "Bus driver allegedly does nothing while black teens attack white schoolgirls." You can read the stories for yourself. They're all on the internet. Or just look in your local newspaper. Again, I ask, is it any wonder that young white people are pushing back against this? Will someone more influential than me, I mean, will someone call to account the race hustlers, college commissars and media shills who are stoking all this anti-white passion? Item. I missed this until I spotted it on Daily Caller. Apparently Donald Trump is a fan of congressional term limits. October 18th, the Donald put forward a plan to limit senators to 12 years, representatives to 6. He actually proposed a constitutional amendment to that effect. Time magazine estimates that this would put 32 senators and 226 Congress critters out of work, with the term work generously defined there. The idea of congressional term limits has been around forever, of course. Newt Gingrich had them in his Contract with America 20 years ago. The trouble is that the people being asked to break the rice bowls are the same people that are feeding from them. The people being asked to empty the trough are the same people that have their snouts in it. Still, with an energetic new administration, anything might be possible. All honour and praise to Donald Trump for at least opening up the idea. I just like this guy more and more. Item Wednesday next week, November 30th, is St. Andrew's Day, the National Day of Scotland. If you are of Scottish stock but have been passing on Burns Night because you can't digest haggis, here's another opportunity to honour your ancestors. Andrew, as we Sunday school graduates all know, Andrew was the brother of St. Peter. He was martyred by crucifixion on an X-shaped cross at Patras in western Greece, the landscape of which, sunshine aside of course, looks just as coarse and craggy as Scotland's. Perhaps that's why they got him as a national saint. What do you eat on St. Andrew's Day? Well, I'm afraid haggis can't be avoided altogether, but it doesn't seem to be compulsory. A nice loin of venison or a shoulder of lamb will do as substitute. And then there's Cullen Skink. How do you make Cullen Skink? Why, you cook up some skink the way they do in Cullen. Don't ask dumb questions. Item, finally, also from Scotland. In the event you succumb to the sin of gluttony over your St. Andrew's Day dinner, you'll be wanting to use cinder. At any rate, you will if you're a Roman Catholic. Cinder is a new smartphone app currently being field tested by that church in Scotland. It gives you interactive maps showing the location of nearby churches and the availability and schedule for confessions. There is, I suppose, a non-zero probability that cinder has actually been snuck into the world by the Prince of Darkness to help him locate sinners and gobble up their souls before they can make it to the confessional. Speaking as a person who, watching my fellow citizens endlessly tapping with their thumbs at those wretched devices, wonders if the devices themselves are not instruments of Satan, I absolutely wouldn't rule this out. Free yourselves from your smartphones, citizens. or prepare to face the eternal fire. That's it, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening, and thanks to whatever deities, sim lords, or other sentient powers have so arranged terrestrial affairs as to bring joy to the heart of an old reactionary this holiday weekend. And speaking of the supernatural, did you darkly suspect that I included that snippet about the Roman Catholic Church at the end there just so that I could sign off with the Vatican rag? Allow me to confirm your suspicion. There will be more from Radio Derb next week. Here's Tom Lehrer, who, by the way, is still with us at age 88.
First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican rag. Processional, step into that small confessional. They're the guy who's got religion. I'll tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer. Drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate us. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen. When in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria, gee, it's good to see you getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican rag.